As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Yeah, a lot of times when we look at the Indo-Pacific, we mainly focus on who are the big players.
Yep.
And just how that's shaping the region. But a lot of times we overlook what these smaller states are. And so we have, whether it's the Pacific Islands, whether it's smaller states like we're going to talk about today with the Maldives, we often overlook them as just kind of passive bystanders and don't pay attention to that these states have preferences as well, and that they also have geostrategic locations that they can leverage. So when we think about this big picture, this big chessboard that is the Indo-Pacific, how are states thinking through how they can leverage that geostrategic location that they have?
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel of the United States Army, retired, and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye, the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 49, Maldives. Small State, Big Stakes, a dialogue with Dr. Andrea Malji. The Maldives, a small island nation of fewer than 600,000 people, sits at the crossroads of vital Indian Ocean shipping lanes. These are the maritime arteries connecting the Middle East to Asia, carrying much of the world's trade and energy. It may be known for its turquoise waters and luxury resorts, but strategically, it's a critical linchpin in the Indo-Pacific geopolitics. Too often, we view small states as passive players, caught between great powers, simply reacting rather than shaping events. But the Maldives turns that idea on its head. It's a powerful case study in small state agency, how a country with limited size or military might can still actively chart its own course in a competitive strategic environment. Today, the Maldives isn't being pushed around, it's making moves. China is investing heavily through the Belt and Road Initiative, funding bridges, airports, and land reclamation. India counters with its own surge of development and long-standing security cooperation. And the United States, well, it's quieter but enduring partner, deepening defense ties and institutional relationships. What makes Malé's approach remarkable is its strategy of selective alignment. This is not a Cold War non-alignment. It's not passive hedging. It's multi-vector diplomacy, aligning with different powers on specific terms, while safeguarding strategic autonomy. The Maldives is learning from its neighbors, especially Sri Lanka, and putting in place key safeguards, greater transparency, stronger parliamentary oversight, and an emphasis on grant-based financing. But risks remain. Take the planned $8.8 billion Maldives International Financial Center. It's a bold vision, but it also raises concerns about potential debt distress and reputational exposure. And domestic politics, like the India Out campaign, can add a new layer of complexity. Yet, as we've just seen with Prime Minister Modi's visit to Malé, which included a major financial package in the state of free trade talks, in the start of free trade talks, the Maldivian leadership has shown a remarkable diplomatic dexterity, stabilizing ties with a major partner, even after a period of public friction. Today, we're fortunate to be joined by Dr. Andrea Malji, an expert in South Asia and Indian Ocean geopolitics. Together, we'll explore how the Maldives is navigating its relationship with China, India, and the United States, what its diversification strategy tells us, and what the future holds for this small state with truly big stakes. Let's begin the dialogue. Andrea Malji, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi, James. Thank you for having me.
Oh, this has been a conversation long in the making, but I'm super glad to have you. As we start, maybe you'll take a minute and you'll share with the audience your story, how you came to be this expert in this area.
Yeah, it started in my undergrad years. I became interested. I was studying diplomacy and international relations. I thought I was going to become a diplomat, go into the Foreign Service. And while I was there, I started doing research and I did an undergraduate thesis on terrorism in Pakistan. And I really developed my interest then for better understanding the dynamics of South Asia. And I really felt at that point in time that South Asia was understudied in the context of the terrorism literature and the things at that point in time. So I expanded into that and developed my interest then. And so rather than taking the Foreign Service exam, I went to graduate school. So I did my PhD in international relations at the University of Kentucky. And while I was there, I developed a love for teaching. I continued studying about terrorism in the subcontinent in India specifically. And so I got really interested in that. But I also developed a love for teaching, especially about South Asia. Again, I still felt that there was not as much representation of people who were focusing on terrorism research at that point in time. So that's where I developed my expertise. I finished my PhD and then I became a professor at Hawaii Pacific University. I was there for 8 years, became a chair of our department there, International Studies. And then I joined here
In
in
January,
January.
right?
And it really melded these two things that I had developed this passion for, which was both I can still continue doing my research, but I can teach here, but the audience is different. And so I'm able to focus on South Asia, do research, and continue teaching. It's just that now we get this diverse group from all over the world. So it really is this perfect fit for me.
Oh, no, I would agree with that perfect fit. I feel this similarly. You were in the region recently, weren't you? Weren't you in South Asia not so long ago?
I was a Fulbright Nehru
Okay.
scholar. I was in Kerala in the city of Trivandrum. I was there in 2022 for the Fulbright. I was there for 8 months studying.
Well, that's exciting, actually. Yeah, and I know we get a number of South Asians here in the center, and we're getting ready to start up a course. We've got some that'll be in, obviously, in every course we're in. Fascinating. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. I wonder, maybe we'll just go ahead and get started now. This first one to talk about is small state strategy. So, across the Indo-Pacific, small states are finding creative ways to navigate the pressure of great power rivalry while also advancing their own interests. So, that is a premise. Let me ask you this question. What tools and strategies allow these small states to shape, not just survive, but shape geopolitical competition in today's Indo-Pacific?
A lot of times when we look at the Indo-Pacific, we mainly focus on who are the big players and just how that's shaping the region. But a lot of times we overlook what these smaller states are. And so we have whether it's the Pacific Islands, whether it's smaller states like we're going to talk about today with the Maldives, we often overlook them as just kind of passive bystanders and don't pay attention to that these states have preferences as well, and that they also have geostrategic locations that they can leverage. So when we think about this big picture, this big chessboard that is the Indo-Pacific, how are states thinking through how they can leverage that geostrategic location that they have, whether it's near key strategic shipping lanes or whether it's near potentially a place where there could be seabed mining? All of these places have importance, and smaller states are realizing, even though they have small GDPs, because of their location, they can use that to leverage how they think about that relationship with larger powers and the agreements that they want to make, whoever those agreements may be with, great powers, medium powers, regional powers.
Yeah, no, I think here in the region, if you were going to ask people to give an example of this, Maldives isn't going to come to the front of their mind. We're going to kind of bring that out today, but 9 out of 10 people are going to say, "Oh yeah, Singapore does that, and they do that well with their location and how they capitalize on that." And so this is in South Asia. Now we're going to pull and understand Maldives better. Let's talk about strategic autonomy. So the Maldives has emerged as a compelling example of this state effectively navigating those complexities. I think we've laid that out well enough. So here's the question. How has Mali managed to craft a multi-vectored foreign policy that distinguishes it from its traditional non-alignment or these hedging strategies and allows it then to selectively engage these competing powers, these large powers that you talked about in the region?
Yeah, so If we think about international relations scholars, a lot of times we still get stuck in this way of thinking from the Cold War era of, bipolarity and alignment or non-alignment. And even though that has been over for more than 30 years, the legacies of that way of thinking still shape how we think today. So we say, oh, this state is, non-aligned, or it's aligned with one side or the other. Or with hedging, we might think, well, they're friends to all and enemies to none. But I think there's an important area between those two extremes of what a lot of states are doing, which is this multi-alignment, which is, yeah, you can be friends with many, but you can also selectively engage based on what your priorities are. So how can you leverage what's important to you, whether that's, you want to focus on infrastructure projects, for example, or you know that you are located in an important area. How can you leverage that based upon who you're engaging with and the strengths that they bring to the table as well? So when we look at the Maldives, what they've been able to do is negotiate re the relationships that they have with India and with China, and we'll talk about also Turkey and Gulf countries, and how that can help develop a much more complex, multifaceted relationship than we think of from this Cold War era of, non-alignment or single alignment. We see not just the Maldives, but other states are doing that as well, just finding a way to navigate in this complex geopolitical atmosphere where they can assert their preferences while still protecting their sovereignty.
I want to pull on, you spoke about, as an example, you spoke about infrastructure. So let's then pull on that. Let's talk about China's infrastructure footprint. They have had, without a doubt, a
Yeah, a lot of
significant
times when we look at the Indo-Pacific,
influence
we mainly focus on who
in
are the big
Maldives. I mean,
players,
their
and just
investment has
how
transformed
that's
key
shaping the
Maldivian
region. But a lot
infrastructures,
of times
including
we
the
overlook what these smaller
Sinhalese
states are. And
Bridge,
so we have,
the
whether it's the
airport
Pacific
expansion,
Islands, whether it's smaller states like we're going to talk
some
about today with the Maldives,
reclamation of
we
land.
often overlook them as just
And all of this
passive
is towards,
bystanders
raising both the
and
economic and the
don't pay
strategic
attention to that these states have
questions we ask
preferences as
ourselves.
well,
So
and that they also have
while they offer
geostrategic
benefit,
locations
what
that
are the
they can
potential dual
leverage.
use
So when we think about this
implications
big
of
picture, this big
accepting
chessboard that is the
this
Indo-Pacific,
assistance?
how are states
Thinking
thinking of
through
large
how they
infrastructure
can
leverage
leverage is
that
going to come with
geostrategic
some
location
potential
that they
risks of
have
this
with
dual
infrastructure, especially in a country with the geography like the Maldives has? It's a bunch of smaller islands that need connectivity. And so that connectivity, that type of infrastructure development is going to be beneficial for the country itself. But of course, with that comes, that does have dual use potential, whether it's, planes that can land or ships that can port. Those are all things that can potentially happen with those infrastructure projects. But at the same time, Malé is benefiting extensively from these types of projects. Instead of having to take a ferry to the airport, you can take a bridge. And that just has such a huge benefit to the country that it otherwise would have never been able to do had it not been for this type of investment. And so, given all of the benefits that come with these types of projects, I think they have been careful in trying to see that, these have immediate impacts. And because of that, rather than thinking about something maybe 15 years down the road that may be beneficial, we can start to see the benefits immediately. And to help understand how this is an immediate impact versus a long-term impact that can be beneficial to us, trying to avoid opaque terms with some of the contracts. Just because Maldives is a small country, it is going to have to rely on outside manpower. It's not going to be able to build the bridge on its own. It's not going to be able to do land reclamation on its own. It is going to have to rely on these powers. So how can you increase parliamentary oversight? There was some legislation that was introduced in the past decade to help with that, including oversight of like some of the contract terms, making sure that it's civilians that are working on some of these projects rather than military officials. Those are some of the ways that they're trying to avoid some of the challenges that may come with these concerns about dual use.
Well, let's take that a little further. Let's talk about the debt avoidance strategy then that is being used. When we think about that, we're thinking about Hambantota and Sri Lanka and how they are this example of how not to do it. And so, what is it that, how is it that the Maldives is avoiding this debt avoidance, debt avoidance strategy and all of this?
So one of the biggest advantages that the Maldives has compared to Sri Lanka is it has hindsight and it can see where things went wrong in other examples, right? So if you have the hindsight, you can learn from the mistakes or challenges that others faced. And so when we come to how that has shaped the strategies that the Maldives is doing now, like I mentioned, with not having these opaque terms, making sure of, who's working on the project, just learning what others have experienced and how to improve upon that, I think are some of the things. But, that hindsight is 2020 is very much an important part of that strategy.
I spoke a little bit about India and in my opening remarks, and I guess what I want to know is how they're working through that domestic friction that they're having with India. I'd mentioned how and recently, Prime Minister Modi had come down and visited with the president. That was precipitated by in October, President Mozui going to India because they had challenges in this from the campaigning in the India Out campaign, and so it felt like they had a lot they had to work through. And so maybe you might speak a little bit about this. How is it that they have worked through this domestic friction?
So India has always kind of seen anybody within its realm or region as part of its family, like it's like a big brother type of thing. And the smaller South Asian states don't always appreciate that sort of approach toward them, is that again, they want to, yes, we are in the same region, but we want to have our own autonomy as well. And so in the case of the Maldives, there was concern over the past decade or so that India had gifted these helicopters to the Maldives, and along with it to help, with the maintenance, the operations of these helicopters, there was also around 75 military personnel that were also there. And this, to many Maldivians, raised concerns about why is there Indian military presence within our territory? And so there's some pushback from that, even asking like, take one of the helicopters back. And so this helped develop into a much larger, what you referred to, the India Out campaign. And given that long-standing historical association, it's within the neighborhood, maybe a little caught off guard or surprised that there was this how much leverage this started to gain within the domestic political sphere within the Maldives. It took on a life of its own. It was something that kind of started on the maybe on the fringe, pushing India away, wanting India to be less involved, to something that turned into a full-scale national campaign of, India Out. And so that was probably one of the most, for India, concerning times, is that there's an entire campaign based on we want India to be involved less in this very close neighbor of ours. And so when you look at, coming to the election in 2023, that's going to be part of the campaign, any observer would look at that and say that this is not good for India-Maldives relations, that this is such a successful campaign. And, the president won, who ran on that campaign. And it even deteriorated slightly after that as well, when there were two different policymakers who had made some commentary that was deemed derogatory towards Prime Minister Modi, where India developed its own campaign of, hey, we're not going to have tourism to the Maldives. We're going to go to Lakshadweep Islands in India instead. So at that point in time, it seemed that they had really reached kind of this low point in India-Maldives relations. But then, if you fast forward to where we're at now, I would say that the relationship between the two is almost the best that it's been in a really long time, because they have forged this new relationship, kind of getting over what some of these challenges were in the past. And I think, India was listening to the Maldives and its concerns, right? It did pull the military and replace them with civilians. And so I think that willingness to listen to what those concerns were and be responsive to that, the Maldivians appreciated that and were willing to kind of reconsider that negotiation. But also, you know, what is the Maldives without having a relation? It's so closely connected to India, whether it's through you know, medical tourism or tourism itself, or Indians coming to the Maldives, that these two are just so closely connected. It would be kind of incomprehensible to see that relationship really deteriorate further. And so, like you mentioned, there's been all sorts of engagements between the president of the Maldives and prime minister of India, you know, visiting one another, signing MOUs with one another, large amounts of new development assistance that India is going to start putting in, including with helping with some of this debt that Maldives has taken on. So we've seen a major improvement just within the last year between these two, where I'd say it went from India out, India's definitely back in.
No, I think that's a good characterization of where this has gone. And let's talk a little bit about the United States then. So, I mean, it has pursued this quieter but a deepening strategic relationship with the Maldives through defense cooperations and institutional ties. I mean, they signed a MOU and agreement here back in 20 early the early 2020s. So what distinct advantage does U.S. engagement offer the Maldives, especially in terms of sovereignty, professionalism, and maritime security? Because it's a different approach, I think.
Yeah, so while we see the infrastructure type projects from both India and China, the United States is just much more selective and specific with the types of engagements that it's having with the Maldives. And so we can see the benefit of that relationship playing out here. For example, with the amount of Maldivians who come to our courses and who participate. And that's elsewhere we see within the US with professional military education, different training agreements, different training exercises that are happening. The US Embassy, you know, opened just a couple of years ago. And that's
Yeah,
an
23, I
indication
think.
of, you know, in 2023, an expansion of US interest. Before, the embassy was just served by Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka. So that was indicative of this expansion. And I think, you know, the US recognizes Maldives, you know, geostrategic important location and is engaging in that way. So, yeah, it is much quieter, but I think the US is taking recognition of how there is this really important partnership. And if you speak to any of the Maldivians that come to the course, you will be immediately so impressed with the what they are bringing to the table as well in terms of their knowledge and their understanding of their position as well.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've had Maldivians in my seminar. Phenomenal security practitioners,
Yeah.
and somebody brings so much great insight. Let's talk about diversification strategy. So, Mali is increasingly engaging with Gulf states and other partners through ambitious ventures like I spoke about in the monologue, the Maldives International Financial Center. And so, here's the question: what's the broader strategic logic behind this diversification, and what are the risks of overextension given the scale of the projects that we spoke about, this project?
Yeah, so this financial center, it was just announced a couple of months ago, a plan to build this, but the budget is very large. It's larger than the entire GDP of the Maldives. And so there's inherent risks in any sort of project that is that big. But it speaks broadly to the strategy that we're talking about that the Maldives has of this multi-pronged engagement with other countries. So when you are an economy like the Maldives, and you are primarily dependent upon tourism or on fishing, then you do not have much economic diversification. And when you do not have much economic diversification, when you get hit by these different tragedies like COVID, for example, we can speak to that here in Hawaii, like what the impacts of that are. It has a major economic impact. And so I think that was one of the many things that prompted the Maldives to reevaluate how can we diversify beyond these two, you know, big players that we have right now, because, you know, tourism is not always guaranteed. And there's all sorts of problems that come with fishing, whether that's, you know, overfishing and depleted stocks that they're going to face in the future. So the strategy of looking outward and beyond the region is one that is, you know, part of how can we diversify beyond what we've relied on, including India. So this project, which comes from Gulf funding, is a hope to go beyond those two major drivers of the economy to do something bigger. But again, with that budget, what are the risks? If this doesn't pay off, then what? Where do we go from there? And so I think there is some concern or skepticism within the Maldives of how this project might advance. But then if it's successful, then there's also a potential for a major change in the direction of the country's economy.
Yeah, no, I can envision if they achieve what their aspirations are on this, it is going to have a massive effect on the economy of the country and just recognition even globally as a center of these things. So it'll be yeah, watch this space. We'll see where this takes us. Let's talk about institutional strength. So the Maldives benefits from internal cohesion, a centralized government, relatively high per capita income. And so when you think about those things, how do these domestic factors enhance Mali's diplomatic agility, and what internal vulnerabilities could still constrain its foreign policy, do you think?
So Maldives doesn't have some of the same challenges that we see in the South Asian neighbors, specifically with fractionalization, whether that's religious, ethno-linguistic fractionalization, like is seen in Sri Lanka, which of course, you know, was part of the reason for the 30-year civil war.
Right.
India faces a lot of these challenges along religious and linguistic lines as well, sectarian in Pakistan and Bangladesh as well. And so Maldives does not have that same challenge. So it does have a higher level of, you know, ethno-religious internal cohesion that is not one. You know, there's not a lot of internal strife happening that we see within the neighbors. And like you mentioned, the higher GDP per capita, of course, gives it, you know, an ability to focus where we've already achieved certain human development standards, that there's some room there, for the movement, there. Another thing is that it is a highly centralized government, and that can be both a benefit and it can be a negative. So
Say more.
as a benefit, because it is a highly centralized government, then that means it can be quite easy to make decisions, and you can do that quite easily. You know, there have been attempts to have, you know, greater checks and balances introduced, and they're working on that, especially since 2018. But because of that, at the same time, you can make these decisions without a lot of oversight. And that also means because it is a, you know, any presidential system, you have a lot of power vested in the leader and the power and responsibility that comes with that. That also means that every time there's a presidential election, the preferences can change. And so we've also seen that historically with the Maldives, is that we have seen this oscillation between preference for what might be seen as toward China versus India. And so you can have an election and you can have things change overnight, and we might see the strategy completely change.
Right.
But that's also benefited in the way that you can quickly make decisions without having the same bureaucratic things that hold things down, like you might see in India, for example, that makes it very difficult to move forward with following through on some of the projects that you've sought to do. It can make things very slow. Where in Maldives, they don't face those same kind of bureaucratic tensions and challenges, that they can move a lot quicker.
Fascinating. Let's talk about endurance of the strategy. So, the Maldives foreign policy, it appears agile, even opportunistic to take advantage of things that are happening around it. But sustaining balance among great powers remains a long-term challenge, probably. So, what indicators or inflection points should we watch as we assess whether the balancing strategy remains viable for the next few years?
I would say looking at the debt and what's going to happen with the debt as some of these loans mature. So there's loan maturation coming through on a major loan within the next year. We want to look and see what the credit ratings look like. Are there going to be any downgrades in the credit rating of the score by the Moody's index? What's the outlook? There's recently a negative outlook that was put out regarding the Maldives economic situation. And so that can be a potential negative indicator of how, even though they are pursuing this multi-alignment, diversification, working with more international partners, that it can be very, very difficult to overcome the challenges of a large debt burden. And small states all around the region can speak to that. So we need to watch carefully what happens as these loans mature, especially within the next year. India has been providing assistance to help with that, with some of the financial packages that it's providing. But we want to pay close attention to what happens with these loans, and that will really set the stage about whether or not some of these other ambitious projects will be successful. I think also watching to see how, yes, there is multi-alignment, but we do seem to be moving closer and closer to India. I think that that's indicative of kind of a little bit of a shift towards. We're going back home a little bit closer to our historical partner and ally in India because we realize that there's maybe some more reliability there, less concern with some of the strategies compared to China and its projects.
We've got quite a few audience questions, so let's take a few of those. This first one's asking about comparative strategy. So, what explains the Maldives' relative success in managing great power engagement compared to other small states like the Solomon Islands or Sri Lanka? Why is Maldives successful and others have had challenges?
So it's still playing out,
Yeah,
and
it
we
is,
hope that it
right?
will be successful, but we're seeing that strategy play out, learning step by step from the mistakes of others. Like I mentioned earlier, learning maybe from missteps by other small states. Solomon Islands signed an agreement with China, and there was a large domestic backlash. Okay, let's not do that. Let's learn from that. Sri Lanka signed, this agreement about the development of the Hambantota port in an area that was highly, underdeveloped, low population density, and it was based on the promise of this long-term shadow of the future. Sometime in the future, this port will be operational, and then it will be very beneficial to you. But lots of financial missteps that happened with that, and other domestic financial considerations for Sri Lanka as well. The Maldives has been very careful in looking at the missteps that these other states have done and how can they learn from that in the strategies that they're pursuing. And again, one of those that I mentioned is, not focusing on this, 20, 30, 40 years, but what is something that we can immediately be focusing on that will benefit us? Getting to the airport without having to use a ferry. That is immediately beneficial. And yes, maybe there's a concern for dual use, but that is very beneficial to the entire population. And we can see quickly the return on investment for a project like that. Being more open and having more oversight and checks and balances in the types of agreements that are being signed, making sure that there's not these opaque agreements, which is something that the PRC likes to do very much, making sure that those terms of engagement are much more clear, which I think is part of the problem that we saw in some of these other countries, especially with Solomon Islands, for example. So, learning from the mistakes of others. And just like other states will look at Maldives' correct steps or maybe missteps, and it'll learn from those as well as it shapes its strategy. So that's how I would characterize their strategy, looking at other states and how to avoid the missteps that others have.
Yeah, nicely said. This next question is asking about Muslim majority partnerships. So, how do shared religious and cultural ties with the Gulf and Islamic countries factor into Mali's strategic diversification beyond the big three we spoke about?
So constitutionally, the Maldives is 100% Muslim. To be a citizen of the Maldives is to be Muslim. And I would say that, yes, that is an important part of its identity. But I would look in the other direction of how other states are choosing to engage with them because of that. So it's not that Maldives is saying we're going to engage specifically with this country because they're Muslim. But instead, we see countries like Turkey, for example, which wants to be a leader in the Islamic world based on those religious cultural ties. and chooses to engage based upon that. So we've seen Turkey, under Erdogan, that's taken, a much more religious drift with the government compared to its secular past. And that's shaping how it's engaging with others, being much more selective with its engagement in the Islamic world. So Turkey being more engaged with the Maldives or with Pakistan. That's part of Turkey's strategy based on religious and cultural identity. South Asia broadly long has ties with migrant workers going to Gulf countries. The Maldives is not an exception there, although certainly the numbers are much smaller compared to a place like India. But that has also shaped of Maldives as well, is that there's been those ties where people go to the Gulf and they come back, they live there, they work there, they come back to the country. That is part of shaping their national identity as well. So yes, being Muslim is an important part of Maldivian identity, but I think it's actually shaping other states, specifically Turkey and maybe Pakistan as well. They see each other as partners as well. They've been doing some joint training exercises that's new, seeing a partnership develop there. So I think that's part of shaping who they are and how they're engaging. But I would not say religion is the driving factor for who they choose to engage with, or else you wouldn't see that engagement with India and China the way that you do.
Yeah, no, helpful. Thank you. This next one's asking about domestic political control. So, how does the Maldives' centralized political structure and technocratic foreign ministry, how does that help or hinder its ability to manage great power relations?
Yeah, we touched on that a little bit
Okay.
earlier with, being highly centralized. That's a legacy of the country's past as well, from as it's transitioned into a more democratic country. And that is both a strength and a weakness that it has, is that it does vest a lot of power into one person, and that president. And that president, based upon their own foreign policy preferences of who they choose to engage with, holds a lot of sway. So we don't see the same level of checks and balances that you might want to see, whether including with judicial oversight or with parliamentary involvement in some of those decisions. But at the same time, because of that, we see decisions that can be made and executed and move really fast on. Even this financial center that we're talking about, funded by the Gulf countries, that is something that is set to, develop very rapidly over the next few years, even within by the end of Muzu's term, if it's, follows the initial deadlines that was completed. That's a substantial
Yeah.
project to be done under just one president in one term. So all of that is part of how they're able to navigate, and I would say make decisions much quicker, not get bogged down in bureaucracy, which is a challenge that, bureaucracy has its pros and its cons. It can make things slow, and sometimes there's a benefit to being slow as you work through things and get things like just how they can be. But then it makes you miss out on opportunities that if you're doing things much later, or slower than you initially intended, it can take a while to see that project actually happen.
Nice. This next question is asked about sovereignty and risk. So, as Maldives expands external engagements, how does it guard against long-term erosion of sovereignty, especially with opaque partners or oversized projects, I guess, like we're talking about? And so, what's that risk and against their own sovereignty by taking this on?
So the opaque contracts is probably alluding to PRC, but I first want to get back to the India Out campaign, because what that alluded to was this willingness to protect the country's sovereignty, a feeling that, India had taken a step too far, getting involved in not only having a military presence with these helicopters, but perhaps being too involved in the domestic affairs of the Maldives. And so yes, it was about helicopters, but it was also about a bigger picture of a feeling that a regional neighbor is trying to intervene too much in the domestic affairs of their country. And so the willingness to have a campaign that centered on that showed that, hey, yes, we have these historical ties. Yes, we're close neighbors, but you also have to respect our sovereignty and what our concerns are as well. And India listened. I think, for the most part. And so that's partly the way is that there is a willingness to push back against things that they feel are a potential violation of their sovereignty. In terms of the opaque contracts, yes, that is something that is certainly a hallmark of a lot of the contracts that the PRC may have, whether it's development of an island, saying, hey, by the way, you could also sign this security agreement and we'll help provide security, that we've seen happen in other countries. There's a risk there. And I think the Maldives, through seeing experiences of other countries, is doing their best to avoid those same risks that they saw in other countries. But it also is a country with a very small GDP. And so sometimes, because you are so in need of some of the infrastructure projects, you do have to make some concessions. And maybe the terms are not exactly what you want. But because it is such a needed project, then they still might agree to it anyway and hope that, by having these conversations about openness and concerns, that it will be able to address some of those early on with those opaque types of contracts that they put forth.
Okay. This next question is taking us back to a strategic finance hub. And so, what are the geopolitical implications of Maldives' plan to launch this $8.8 billion offshore financial center, especially given its scale and its backers? So, I guess the nuance here is the geopolitical implications for doing this.
So you said 8.8 billion,
I did.
and what it, we know that the GDP of the Maldives in
7 point
total is
something.
less than
Yeah.
that. So again, very potentially risky because of that, but potential large payoff as well if it helps diversify the economy. So we'll see over the next few years where that goes. But also, again, this is indication of how the Maldives does want to prioritize outside of South Asia.
Yeah.
And leverage its location, not just, as somewhere that's beautiful for tourism or great for fishing, but that can be seen as something else in a very strategic location as this part of a financial hub. So it's an economic diversification, but it's also the location of where this economic diversification is happening. What does it mean to have this global financial hub if it so develops in the location where it's at, where you have all of these strategic shipping lanes? What are the potential impacts of that? How does that shape how China or India might want to engage with the Maldives, knowing that you're turning into this potential finance hub? How does that shape other concerns about money laundering, drug trafficking? All of these things are things that come along with the development of these types of financial hubs. So these are multifaceted problems, but indicative of how Maldives wants to move beyond where it's at right now.
Yeah, and I mean, you even mentioned earlier about how this reaches out to Gulf states, and therefore, not just the big three are you engaging with, but you're expanding your reach to more parts of the world, and can get beyond that typical structure that they must that which they deal with been dealing with.
Yeah, beyond India, but beyond China. And we know that the Gulf states, whether that's Qatar or the UAE, they have a lot of financing available. And then going back to this Islamic ties as well, there's similar views on financing, for example, about like what Islamic financing looks like as well. And so that's another thing that can be beneficial. About the types of the terms of the agreements of the loans, for example. And so those things all tie into the big picture as well.
Let's take one more question. This one's asking about small state trends. And so, do you see the Maldives as part of a broader trend of small state strategic assertiveness in the Indo-Pacific? And if so, what else or who else is charting a similar course to this?
I think that the Maldives has done a stronger or more clear examples because of this multi-alignment that maybe we don't see in other places, but I also don't think it's entirely unique either. So I think that we are seeing similar types of multi-alignment all throughout the Pacific Islands. They are maybe more so than the Maldives facing the front lines of, violation of their EEZs, whether that's through, illegal, unregulated, unreported fishing, or patrols that are happening within and outside of their EEZ. And so I think we're starting to see more multi-alignment as we see they see growing threats from PRC. They're maybe pushing back on that. But I still see it as kind of more of a alignment with, you know, one side or the other, US or China, whereas in Maldives we have kind of this multi-alignment that we don't see as evident within some of the Pacific islands. So I would say Maldives for sure is leading the way. I think Seychelles to some extent we'll see that as well. Some say Fiji. Yeah.
I'm going to ask you for a book recommendation, but I should make note that actually you wrote a paper that was on War on the Rocks recently. I think I stole the title. I think it was Maltese, Small State, Big Stakes.
That is the title.
Yeah, it was a good title. I thought it would amplify it here. But your paper. So I encourage viewers to check that out. It as you and I were talking, you'd mentioned that it was actually well received on well viewed on more of the on the rocks, and would note that you had a number of links in there, and I was, in fact, I read through your article a couple times as I was preparing for this, and so it not beyond your article, there was a lot of hyperlinks that took you places. And one of the places that took me was our own webpage, where the center had done a video on the Maldives. Former director had gone in there and engaged. I don't think I saw that video previous, but it was really fascinating to see the reach that the center has had in the Maldives and the contacts it's had. And so I share that with the guests to do. But share with us a book recommendation.
Yeah, just to go back a little bit, the War on the Rocks, they hadn't had a piece on the Maldives in a few years, and so they said that the article ended up getting a lot of hits for that week, and there was and I got a lot of messages from people who were just, hey, we don't get to see Maldives being talked about very often, especially on these kind of pretty I'll say heavy on the IR pages like we see on War on the Rocks, very policy security heavy. And so Maldives doesn't make an appearance there very often. So it was a little bit of a change of pace to see it mentioned there.
Well, I should mention that the timing was near perfect. It came out mid-July, and as I note, the 26th of July, the Maldives celebrated its 60th anniversary for independence, and so it was nearly timed with that. A lot has been going on in the Maldives in celebration of this, and even better than I do on that. But the timing was pretty good, so
It was good timing. Yes.
yeah.
Yeah. The book that I would recommend
Yeah.
is coming out
Okay.
in November, and I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy
Ooh.
to look through it, but I wanted to make sure I get it right because there's three authors. So it's Small States in a Shifting International Order, and that's by Kristen Williams, Stephen Lobel, and Neil Jesse at Georgetown University Press. And so they do, I think, six or seven case studies of small states and how they are also using this kind of strategy of multi-alignment. I think there's only one case in Nepal that they do from the Indo-Pacific, and the rest are outside of the region. So I think adding Maldives to the mix is a good way to go. But yeah, I think we need to pay more attention to small states. They're not just passive bystanders. They all are engaging in the geopolitical landscape of the region.
Andrea, thank you for coming on the show and for talking with us about this and just spending the hour together. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, James.
Yeah. As we conclude today's dialogue, we've learned how a small island nation can wield big strategic influence, navigating great power rivalries with remarkable agility and for its own benefit. The Maldives is a powerful lesson in how agency is not just geography. Defines a country's role in the Indo-Pacific. These conversations shape security. So join us on August 18th when I sit down with Dr. Victor Cha for episode 51, North Korea's Wartime Windfall, to explain how the war in Ukraine has fundamentally saved Kim Jong-un's regime. On behalf of all of us at DKIAPCSS, thank you for being part of this important dialogue. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha oi.
As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.